Good morning, everyone. It's great to see you all. In the light of the studies that we're doing, can you just imagine how great it would be to see each other if when, you know, Chris came and opened up, he's like, phew, the government didn't come and shut down this building. And then we come and, oh, instead of Pastor John coming from visiting his family, his son, Pastor John comes from a year of jail. Just helpful to think in that mindset as we consider these men who that was normal experience. It was by the later part, like around the time the confession came, there was the act of toleration. But before that, between when the Westminster was put together and that, there was decades of persecution. So to go along with Pastor John's series on the confession itself, we're looking at the men who put it together. We're going to do a brief review. We're not going to spend a lot of time. These are pretty wordy slides here, but I'm just going to pick out a few highlights for the people that weren't here. So first, we looked at why study these people, and we looked at how Christian history is ultimately his story, God's story. So it's not fundamentally about the Baptists or about any character or any movement. It's fundamentally about what God is doing in and through his people. And even though we may not be a historian, we want to look at the progress of the gospel as something that's of interest to us, no matter who we are. Now, it could be very surface level. It doesn't have to be deep. We don't have to be reading a lot about it, but we should. There's something wrong if we're a Christian and we can't rejoice in the progress of the gospel, whether it's in the 17th century or the first century, right? And there was this quote, "These people are your spiritual family. Now, there may not be much family resemblance in some ways. There may be a lot of resemblance in other ways, but we are one family." We looked at pitfalls to avoid, and there's a need for balance here. We don't really want to be saying everything old is good or nothing old is good, so we don't want to idealize, sugarcoat. We don't want to look for heroes too quickly. Sometimes we end up with very problematic things happening when we're just too quick to look. We're always trying to idealize someone and make them our hero. And then bad habits from school. I tried to comfort everybody with the fact that we don't need a cram for an exam here. We're trying to get the flavor of someone's life here. We're trying to get to know them. So just pretend that you're trying to get to know your neighbor or your friend, someone at church. You're trying to get to know a person. You're not trying to get a list of facts. So we'll continue on here. We looked at who they were. There were 25 men, mostly pastors, but they weren't all pastors. There was some messengers who were, for instance, we know one example of a man that was, you know, preaching quite similarly to Al or Mike occasionally, but was not ordained to any office, but represented a church. Representing 100 churches. We talked a little bit about the subscribers versus signers. Nothing wrong with signers, but technically speaking, some of them were actually dead before their names were put on these documents. So they were at the assemblies. They agreed with these statements, but their names weren't on the document. In fact, there were no names on the document until 1699. So, for instance, Hansard Knowles was dead by then. And then we looked at Hansard Knowles being the elder statesman. He had lived as an adult through all the way from the golden age of Puritanism through the persecution to the act of toleration. Now, he didn't quite make it to when his name was put on the document, but he almost did. Because of a technical issue, we actually had these quotes here on the right side cut off of the screen, so we have them here now. So I'm just going to read this. "Holiness is an ornament to your callings, to your persons, to your families, and to the place where you live. The more holy, the more like your Heavenly Father, the more you glorify your Heavenly Father, and the more you adorn the doctrine of Christ. Yea, the more communion you have with the Father and with Christ." And we talked about how he was basically, he had a full life even before he even became a Baptist. He lived in England. He came to America. He was less persecuted in America than in England, but still was not treated well. And he went back to England and then had 50 years of fruitful ministry. This was an insult that was given to him in Boston. Absurdo, no less. Okay. Oops. This was not included in the last slide. This is actually a receipt for a book purchase that he made. The handwriting of the bookseller. So again, 50 years, key in church planting. I'm going to skip over this. William Kiffin was our next figure, a key figure. No theological training, but a brilliant man. Very curiously, he was rich. Apparently, he loaned money to King Charles. He used that influence for good. He helped General Baptists as well as particular Baptists when they were being persecuted. But his life was bookended by tragedy. Unfortunately, his political alliance with King Charles cost him both of his grandsons because when the times change, sometimes there's issues with that, with who you knew and who you supported. And we see a quote from him: "The world is full of confusions. Last times are upon us. The signs of the times are very visible. Iniquity abounds, and the love of many in religion waxes cold. God is, by his providence, shaking the earth under our feet. There is no foundation of rest, but only in Jesus Christ." So this is really just a quick tour. If you want to get into detail on that, you can listen. The first presentation is on the church website. It's not on YouTube, but it's on the church website. So we're going to get to Benjamin Keach, and this is probably, arguably, the most well-known of these men. As you can see, his dates, he lived well past when his name was put on the confession, a good amount of years. So he was a prolific writer. As you can see, 40 published works. He wrote a work of fiction that's actually quite similar to Pilgrim's Progress. It's called The Travels of True... This is actually interesting. The Travels of Godliness is the one I have. I couldn't find the book, but this is The Travels of Ungodliness. So the flip side. And you can see it's by Ben Keach. So as we've seen when we were learning about Spurgeon, he pastored what would become Spurgeon's church. He had, just like Hansard Knowles, he had 1,000 attendees in his church, like well before Spurgeon had his big gatherings. His parents couldn't afford to send him to school, so he worked as a tailor in his early years. Unlike some of the other pastors, as I mentioned in the last lesson, because of the persecution, there was a lot of transience, and generally speaking, things that we take for granted with our pastors and things that are applicable in ideal circumstances weren't in place. The vast majority of these men were actually not formally theologically educated. Again, because you had Cambridge had very similar theology in a lot of ways, but you were dissenters. You were not part of that mainstream, especially as Baptists. And also in terms of supporting the pastors, a lot of these men had jobs. I mean, Kiffin got rich being a cloth merchant, and I believe the next pastor we're going to learn about, Hercules Collins, if I remember correctly, he had to support himself for a while. I think eventually the church was able to support him. So it was different times, and it was difficult. But Keach was one that was supported, I believe. He became a Baptist at age 15 in the General Baptist movement. The General Baptists, as we said last time, were Baptists that did not agree with the doctrines of grace. They believed in a general atonement. They would not, they would not be agreeing with the 5 points of Calvinism. He became a General Baptist. He entered the ministry as a General Baptist too, and we can see in his ministry later on some elements of General Baptist influence. Some of the things he advocated for later on were coming from that, but he definitely ended up rejecting their view of salvation, of the doctrines of grace. So he only made it to 24 before he was arrested. And imagine you start preaching at 18 years old, and by 24, essentially the powers that be call you a seditious, heretical, and schismatic person, evilly and malicious disposed to His Majesty's government and to the government of the Church of England. Just imagine that, having that after, you know, maybe 6 years of ministry. His crime? He wrote a book of instruction for children. As far as I can gather, that book is actually not wholly religious even. It was talking about God, but I think its purpose was broad. I mean, there was no strict separation between religion and education, right? But part of the goal of that book was to teach kids some basic skills of reading and writing and stuff like that. His punishment, jail, a fine, being pilloried, and a book burning. So this is what happened. You basically get posted into this wood and people throw stuff at you. Now, when this happened, he preached. And this was not something that was unique. This wasn't like an anomaly. It happened later on. In fact, later on, he was almost trampled by horses by a Calvary that he was preaching to. So this man, you know, went up against some pretty steep things to deal with in the beginning of his ministry. He had an itinerant ministry and eventually moved into London for 36 years of pastoral ministry, again at the church that Charles Spurgeon would be at. Okay, so Thomas Crosby, as you can see here, said, "Preaching the gospel was the pleasure of Keach's soul, and his heart was so engaged in ministry that to the end of his days, his life was one continued scene of labor and toil." So when I think of Keach, these are the two theological contributions I can think of. His defense of the doctrines of grace, being a General Baptist, he came to embrace the doctrines of grace, and he was very robust in this. He avoided hyper-Calvinism. Now, a later pastor of this church between him and Spurgeon, John Gill, would have some pretty serious charges against him of hyper-Calvinism. And there's some debate over, was he a hyper-Calvinist, how much of a hyper-Calvinist he was, but Keach very clearly avoided going to extremes on hyper-Calvinism. And that is one thing that characterizes these men, all of them that we've covered. They all held up the sovereignty of God in salvation, but evangelism didn't get neglected. In fact, with Hansard Knowles, he would be the one that comes to mind when you think of someone who was a model evangelist, as well as holding strongly to these doctrines about God's sovereignty and salvation. Spurgeon said he was intensely direct, solemn, and impressive, not flinching to declare the terrors of the Lord, not veiling the freeness of divine grace. And just, if you can look at one of the supplications in his sermons, "Come, venture your souls in Christ's righteousness. Christ is able to save you, though you are ever so great sinners. Come to him, throw yourself at the feet of Jesus." So the hymn singing part bears a little bit of explanation, because it might sound a little bit weird to our modern age. In the 1600s, before Isaac Watts wrote tons of hymns, hymn singing, or actually any singing in public worship, was not a given. In fact, the General Baptist, which might come as a surprise to some, the Arminian Baptists of those days generally did not accept singing at all as an element in worship. At all. But when it comes to the mainstream Puritan circles and many Baptist circles, there were many who approved of singing in worship, but then would stop at uninspired hymns. So there still are Presbyterians to this day who would only sing psalms in worship, for instance. So not only did the particular Baptists who were involved in this confession have to come to justify the presence of singing as an element of worship, they had to justify the singing of hymns. But I must say, to begin with, there was not consensus among these men on this issue. They all agreed that singing should be a part of worship, but they were not all agreed about the singing of uninspired hymns. And if you look at them, these are not just theoretical points. They were also bringing their congregations along in these understandings. Keach was a hymn writer, but by most accounts, he was a terrible hymn writer. Almost every historian says he was not a good hymn writer, but he was a brilliant advocate of it. And in fact, if you look, his hymns kind of prefigure the modern missionary movement. That's another thing that we live in today. We take it for granted that missions are a good thing. We take it for granted that it's a wonderful thing that people are going to other nations and preaching the gospel. Before people like William Carey and a few others, that was not necessarily taken for granted always. So, you know, when we say not everything old is good, we do have to remember that there were development in people's understandings. And as these people were working out these issues, and not, you know, we have some developments that we're very thankful to God for. So he talked about dark Spain, Italy, Asia, Africa, and even wild America, which is an interesting, because of how unpopulated and there was not much development there. So before we started this series, we did the Lord's Supper. I believe, was it the Lord's Day before you left, Pastor John, or maybe two? We were singing a hymn after the Lord's Supper, and I was just thinking, Keach, sometime between 1673 and 1675, for the first time with his congregation, the first hymn sung as part of their services introduced a hymn after the Lord's Supper. And in fact, some years later, they would have a vote in the church to introduce a hymn after every single service. So this is, I mean, again, it's hard for us to understand. Taking ourselves and putting us over there, it would be hard to imagine that, but you have to understand that this was not a weird quirk of the Baptist. These were issues that were being worked out overall. Now, so if we see Keach played a particular role in the movement. He was very well known, he had a lot of writings, and he was a strong advocate for their views. Like, he was really a champion of the particular Baptist. In fact, he's the only one, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, of the people who were involved in this confession that made it into Joel Beakey's Meet the Puritans. Now, Bunyan's there, but as we said the other day, Bunyan is in some ways an outlier in terms of some of his views of church polity and church, the way the church was governed and how it was carried out. And so he... In some ways, his influence on the Baptist movement was actually not that strong. Like, he's really, really well known. But people like Kiffin, Knowles, Keach were much more influenced on what happened in Baptist life than Bunyan. Now, Bunyan had a broader audience and probably was more well known outside of Baptist circles. We just got this working, so I keep on trying to go there. Okay, whoa, what did I just do? There has to be a technical glitch at some point. So, as we know, sometimes our best features can also be a flaw. Keach was a very independent thinker. He also had some strongly held views that were not represented in the confession. And one thing I think that is helpful to remember in this series is that This was a consensus document, as I said before. Not every one of their strongly held views made it into the confession. This was a consensus document. They had deliberations. With the Westminster, we have actually extensive notes of those deliberations, so we have a little bit more of a picture into what happened. But these guys disagreed on some things. And one thing that Keach held to strongly, and also the next man that we'll look at Hercules Collins, was the laying on of hands during baptism, after baptism. And when the London Baptist Confession came to the United States, it was basically published as the Philadelphia Confession, and they actually added one to two items in there, and one of them was the laying on of hands. Now, that practice came to America. Keach's influence is felt there, but it kind of withered away at that point. So he had a well-known flaw. Joel Beakey in Meet the Puritans mentions it. Keach was a kind, gentle, and temperate man, but was prone to outbursts of temper. He was said to be intolerant of alternative viewpoints and prone to single-mindedness. Now, Crosby puts a little bit more of a positive spin on it. He mentions these things, but he does say, if his natural passion at any time so far transported him as to cause him to speak any rash or offensive words, he was presently recovered, and with the greatest humility and frankness, retract what he said. And there's actually some objective evidence that supports this in history. So I think Crosby's assessment is quite correct from what we can tell from obviously limited evidence. So Keach had a rebellious son who came to America, to Philadelphia, and fraudulently preached. He was not converted himself. He used his father's name and legacy, and he was dramatically converted while he was preaching. Like almost, it wasn't like dropped dead or something like that, but he was like stopped in his tracks while preaching, essentially, and in a very vivid conversion. He had a fruitful ministry, and he returned to England. He died before his father. So Keach passed away. We're obviously skipping a lot of history, but he passed away, and he's rightfully regarded the end of the era. By the time Keach was dead, there was nobody that we're talking about still alive. And he's had a great legacy. One interesting note here that shows that perhaps Crosby's observation was correct is when he was on his deathbed, he chose the man to preach his funeral sermon. It was a man that he had an intense theological debate with. He chose a man that believed that the proper day of worship, the Lord's Day, was Saturday. He chose that man to preach his funeral. Keach even had a sermon series against Stennett's views. But their friendship was close. Keach respected him very highly. And obviously he was probably pretty worked up to be in this debate, but he definitely maintained a close friendship with him. Unfortunately, as has happened a lot lately, Stennett was sick and they had to reschedule and have someone else do the sermon. I don't know who did it, but okay. Hercules Collins, and I don't know that we're going to do full justice to him, but mercifully for time, there's not a whole lot known about Hercules Collins. We do have his signature. We do not have a portrait. So Keach called him his honored father. Little is known about his early life. He was probably raised in a Christian home based on the fact that he was baptized as an infant, and there's some other evidence of Christian influence. But and Michael Haken has asked this question: why did these Christian parents name him after a pagan Greek hero? Interesting food for thought. So there's a funeral sermon. I don't remember who preached his funeral sermon, but that's where we get most of our details. Preaching at age 22. The Petit France Church was a very significant church in the particular Baptist movement. It was pastored by William Collins, but there's no relation between them. There's some suspicion that Hercules Collins may have been a member there. He took up a pastor in Wapping in 1676 or 1677. He worked as a tailor to supplement his ministerial income. This was a really down and out place. You know, London was the second largest city. This was one of the poorer areas of London. We have very little details about Church Collins or Hercules Collins, but we have a lot of details from their church minutes. Every single meeting, they took minutes. We have notes of it. We have some interesting anecdotes about Hercules Collins on many discipline cases. Like, it just seemed like that was like almost a routine thing. I don't know if that it was weekly, but it was very, very frequent. So they had a lot of difficulty. We have documents. We have two receipts that show the list of books that their church purchased for brothers who were seen as gifted. They were not ordained. They probably would be eventually, who were gifted. And we have a list of their books. Very interesting to see the priority they put on that. This is an interesting one. I just think it was too interesting to pass up. So we know very little about him. But on Christmas Day 1677, and keep in mind, he just became pastor in 1676 or 1677. So he's been pastor for maybe a year or two. They carried out church discipline against a man. The church carried out church discipline against a man. And one of the sins listed, there was three or four sins. One was praying for Pastor Collins' death. So Pastor John, the pastoral life is not easy. I hope and pray take joy in that has not happened. But there's another anecdote that I found highly interesting. We know from some evidence that Collins had a robust vision of Reformed Congregationalism. He had a high view of the authority that the gathered church has. So something to keep in mind when we're making a vote as a congregation, that's something that's honorable, important. It's not something to be done loosely. Hercules Collins was in jail. He was still the pastor of this church. He was in jail. He had a disagreement with his congregation over the Lord's Supper. They decided that they wanted to do the Lord's Supper in his absence and appoint someone to do it. He disagreed. Now, Hercules Collins did not change his mind on that. But the church voted on it, and he supported that vote, which shows a great deal of humility and patience. He basically told them, your vote holds until we get back and we can discuss it more and vote again. So he did not, there was not evidence of a strong will. He still disagreed with them. He saw a process to address this issue, but he was not going to, like, you know, the accusation of lording over the congregation. In light of that, it would be very hard to say that he had a real, like forceful and violent sort of authority, right? So it was very interesting. He supported that. And you can see the dilemma when the church is functioning normally and suddenly your pastor has a year spell in jail. That is an extremely difficult thing to deal with. There was two periods of imprisonment. They were fairly short, like compared to Bunyan or some of the others. There was a two-month period, and there was also a one-year period. The two-month period was under the Second Conventicle Act. He had some good company. It was not necessarily at the same time, but Thomas Manton, Richard Baxter, John Owen, Thomas Goodwin, William Kiffin, Knowles, these men all were imprisoned for various periods for that. Then he was in prison for a year. There were 4,000 dissenters arrested during the 1680s. Now, curiously, Collins failed to appear to court, which is interesting. I don't know why. I don't know what justification he had for that. But he failed to appear. He was arrested during a church meeting. They actually came into the meeting. I don't know if he was preaching or sitting down, but they did that. He went to the infamous Newgate prison. He had an amazing prison writing ministry. He wrote at least two of his most significant books there. And his writings are just like gems. So this is something important to remember, especially when as at times Christians seize political power, as at times we're not on the persecuted end of the spectrum. A persecuting spirit is not of a gospel complexion. So if you're persecuting someone for their views, you are not exhibiting a gospel complexion. Let men and devils do their worst. God will, in his own time, lose the prisoners. And then finally, believers are taught in the school of affliction. That is something to be learned there, which is not ordinarily learned by other ways. So he has 12 published works, mostly about baptism and separation from the Church of England. There is a newly published version of, or edition of his, An Orthodox Catechism. This is basically a Baptist version of the Heidelberg. He was a poet. He was also an early advocate of hymn singing. In fact, some editions of this have an appendix on the duty of congregational singing, which was pretty radical at that time. Though in some sense I cannot preach Christ too much, yet I preach so as to neglect the preaching up of duty. I leave undone a great part of the work committed to my charge. Though it is our duty to preach Christ crucified, the object of a justifying faith, yet it is not to be done to the neglect of preaching up other duties, especially the great doctrine of repentance. So I'm not going to read these, but you can see his catechism on the Lord's Supper. How should the Lord's Supper be closed? Says, singing a hymn or a psalm. So he's very very front and center, making a priority of hymns should be, hymns and psalms should be in worship, and they're especially suitable to close the Lord's Supper. Now, I'm not going to read this right now because we are a bit short on time, but at his funeral sermon, someone said, Collins has the three qualifications for a gospel minister. And it just gets into how what a great ministry he had and how he served God. Okay, so just to wrap up, this is